saying, keep going into this very detailed, complex evaluation of Krishna and his energies and how the whole thing works. So what I thought I would do is begin this morning's discussion with reading something that I made reference to yesterday, which is Vyasa Puja offering provided by Shivara Maharaj to Srila Prabhupada in 2002, a few years ago. And we'll understand how Srila Prabhupada prepared us to be fixed in our convictions about the existence of transcendental supreme personality of Godhead. And one can even go beyond that, and that is, he has provided us with the means to, on the strength of scriptural authority, to dismiss misconceptions, including the popular ones. We have to listen carefully. And, you know, there's kind of like brain fatigue, because it's not about sense pleasure, or it's not about money, or it's not about something that may be of interest in the material field. It's not about something temporary, it's about something, it's about knowing who we really are, which means to know who is Krishna. So, we covered a number of topics, just looking back, kind of, so this is a little review. The non-material or the spiritual nature of Krishna's form, Krishna's name, Krishna's energy, and because it's Bhagavat Sandarbha, so what is the nature of Bhagavan? That's, and it's not a creation of material energy, because you'll hear. We heard yesterday, day before yesterday, about Krishna's name, that it's not something material. Remember? Yes? There are names of things that are material, and that's how you identify them. Like, you know, I'm looking at a chair. So when you say the word chair, in the mind, there's a conception of what a chair is. And then there is one. Or, because when I, and my sense perception, I'm looking at it, I know what it is. Let's just say it's something I don't know what it is. Like a cricket bat. You know, you all know what cricket bats look like, and I don't. But, you know, now I have some idea, oh, that's a cricket bat. But until I had some idea in the mind, then I didn't know what it was. Maybe it's so many things. And then as you have a clearer idea in your mind, then you can identify varieties of cricket bats and so forth and so on. So that's what we're doing with hearing, getting a spiritual conception of what Bhagavan is and Krishna, his form, and then he's just going through the list. His potencies, his qualities, his name, his associates, and all of that spiritual, non-material nature. And we're not used to looking at things in a non-material way. We're used to looking things in a material way, so it takes some adjusting. But supposing you don't have that association with disciplic succession, then you have a material conception. And supposing you go to the scriptures and don't have disciplic succession, you're going to get a material conception. And that's a big part of what Mayavad conception is. It's without disciplic succession, they go to the scriptures and they read it this way. The negation of material, and that's Brahman. If you want to be spiritual, but you don't have disciplic succession, that's where you're going to end up. At best, there's all kinds of other places you can end up. But at best, an actual spiritual conception of the Brahman feature of the Supreme Lord and think that's it. And then when it comes to Krishna's form, Krishna's name, Krishna's qualities, Krishna's activities, it changes. There's a big shift. So we're going to hear Shivram Maharaj's. I'm going to go through it and point out there's five different places where he's the proponent of something spiritual, and he's going to hear back something that's a non-spiritual conception of something spiritual and refute it. I'll say it again. A non-spiritual conception of something that's spiritual. A material conception of something that's spiritual. An impersonal conception. And we're going to hear how Prabhupada prepared us for this, in one case, somebody who has listened carefully and has contemplated what he has heard and is able to speak, firmly. Strongly. With some, energy. To dismiss a slap in Krishna's face. Excuse me. So, going forward, we're going to hear in this section today more about Krishna's name. We're going to hear more about Krishna's form and its spiritual, non-material reality. We're going to hear something about the colors of Krishna's form, and that's not material either. Although color is sometimes in the Vedas associated with the modes of nature, but Krishna's color is not associated with the modes of nature. We're going to hear. So we're equipped. If someone says, or in our own mind, if we're like still looking at Krishna with the lens of the material ideas that we've been brought up with in modern education, we'll be able to take a look at it through a different lens. So here's, it's 2002, and he begins, he's a very good writer too, by the way. Dear Srila Prabhupada, introduction. I meditate upon those glittering particles of dust, which, by the prayers of your true followers, have received the great fortune of always cushioning your lotus feet. He's meditating upon the dust. He calls them the glittering particles that cling to his lotus feet and always cushion your feet. How fortunate they are. May I also become a grain of dust, forever united with your divine service? On the occasion of your Vyasa Puja, I would like to narrate an incident that took place last year, so 2001. Knowing your fondness for trouncing Mayavadis, I am confident this story will bring you some pleasure. And us too. In fact, my hope is that I may reap the reward of your wide, unrestrained, and ever beauteous smile. So, 2001, July. A well-known Hindu organization launched a worldwide yatra on the grounds of the Bhaktivedanta Manor. To preside over the function, they invited many spiritual leaders. To draw a crowd, they imported a popular bhajaneer that works. A Bollywood star and a bhajaneer, and you got the crowd. Most likely, out of courtesy, they sent me an invitation because it was held at the Bhaktivedanta Manor. They had the space. When I saw the melange of spiritual dignitaries, I had second thoughts. On the stage were to be two yogis, a guru, a Shankaracharya, and myself. Compromising association, exclamation point. I inquired about the scheduled speeches and was assured that I would have equal time. After consultation, I decided to make the best of the situation and participate. Paragraph. Sheltering over 10,000 guests, the tent was the largest ever erected at the manor. Big tent, 10,000. The guests received prasadam, chanted Hare Krishna, and saw Radha Gokulananda, the deities at the manor. After all the dignitaries had arrived, the main speakers took their places on stage, and the function began. There was little value in detailing all the speeches. They included the standard fare of rambling rhetoric and humanistic cliches punctuated with nationalistic slogans and calls for cultural renaissance. Oh, so drab. When my turn came, I spoke for 20 minutes on the meaning of Sanatana Dharma. I emphasized that the brotherhood of man can take place only when we accept our common father, Sri Krishna, and serve him by chanting his names. Then, sitting beside me, the Shankaracharya, a small chubby man my age, with an ignoble tendency to fidget, spoke, regularly alternating between Hindi and English. In addition to eloquent servings of mishmash, common to the other speakers, His Holiness made philosophical points clearly targeted at his hosts, namely ISKCON devotees, and more specifically, their lordships, Radha Gokulananda. When, obviously for my benefit, he said in English, so listen, "It does not matter which name you give God, for all names are temporary." I sat erect and chanted japa loud enough to distract him. In response, he diligently continued to churn the mishmash, but, true to form, he returned to his Mayavad Siddhanta to exclaim, again, names. "The names of God are immaterial," I mean, not important. "For above name and form is the formless, eternal." I chanted aloud, "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna." And he said, as he said, "Brahman." And my voice rang through his microphone. When the Shankaracharya snarled at me, I glared at him. As I looked into his eyes, I understood the nature of his glance. It was a glance that caught me when we first met, a glance whose description then eluded me. But that glance was a mystery no more. I understood in one word, evil. So, you know, Krishna is fighting the demons. The devotee is fighting the Mayavadi who is attacking Krishna. This is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu meant when he said, Mayavadi Bhasha Sunide Haya Sarva Nash. Meaning, everything is destroyed by hearing Mayavad philosophy. I repeated the verse under my breath as the Shankaracharya faced the audience. I continued to chant japa loud enough for the Shankaracharya to hear. Through his speech, he made one more colossal jab, describing the ultimate as pure knowledge and the worship of deities as a temporary means to Brahman. Then it was over. Thank the Lord. By now my pulse was pounding, and there were still speeches and bhajans to sit through. I felt that Srila Prabhupada, our society, and of course Krishna, had been grievously offended. If I said nothing, I would melt in shame. So he said something. Another yogiji began his speech, and I leant over the arm of my chair and smiled, Swamiji. The Shankaracharya turned to face me. I have something to say. He nodded. In your talk, there were some highly objectionable points. They were neither shastric nor appropriate to say on our premises, I said. Challenge. There we were, the Shankaracharya and I, in the midst of soul-sedating speeches, engaged in an animated, unamplified debate on a stage full of dignitaries and in plain view of thousands. Later, devotees asked me, were you having an interfaith dialogue? Hardly. The Shankar replied, what I have said is all right. No, I interjected, smiling. In Krishna's temple, you have said that Krishna is the subordinate manifestation of Brahman. You said the absolute truth in reality is nirguna. That is both impolite and against the Vedic conclusion. So he's now digging into the protecting Krishna's honor. His eyes opened wide at my challenge. Then, leaning closer, the Shankaracharya said, but Krishna says, so maybe you recognize this verse, see if you recognize where this verse comes from. Shashvatasya cha dharmasya sukasyai kantikasya cha. Recognize where that comes from? We study Bhagavad Gita, we take Bhakti Shastri. It's one of the last verses, if not the last verse of chapter 14. And the meaning is, he says, the basis of happiness is the ultimate, capital U, namely Brahman. So it's philosophy, but he's heard and studied the philosophy carefully, Shivramar, so he responds. As Yogiji, the current speaker, was making an animated speech, I had to speak loudly. No! You are misrepresenting Krishna. He first says, Brahmano hi pratishtaham. That's the verse, 14:27. Brahmano hi pratishtaham. And then, you know, this Brahman, which I am the basis and support of, is the foundation for real happiness. But I'm the basis and support of that. He says, Brahman rests on him. If one thing rests on another, it is because it is subordinate and dependent. The logic as well as the sloka. Likewise, Brahman rests on Krishna because it is subordinate to Krishna. And it is Krishna who is the ultimate. That's the first exchange. Now, we've all read that verse. We probably can say it. Brahmanohi pratishtaham. There we go. So how does it apply when you meet someone that says, no, Brahman is the ultimate? The Shankaracharya was taken back. It appeared that he did not expect me to know the verse he had quoted. You do not understand, he said. So more on that verse. I interrupted him over thunderous applause for Yogiji, and who knows what he said. So I understand pratishta, I replied. It means Brahman rests on Krishna and is dependent on him. There's no ambiguity in the meaning of the word pratishta. What other meaning is there? You tell me if you know better. The Shankaracharya was clearly flustered by my assault. He smiled me away and said, there is no defect in Brahman. It is perfect and complete. Om Purnamadak Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate. I completed the sloka again to his surprise. Then I said, yes, it is perfect and complete, but behind Brahman is its source and rest, a person. That's the second. So 14:27, and then the invocation mantra to Ishopanishad. You know, it's knowing what it is and what its implication is. He waved his hand to dismiss my argument. I looked out over a sea of faces. The guests were alternating between hearing Yogiji, who was now singing a bhajan, and observing my argument with the Shankaracharya. It was a double performance. He's a good writer, huh? The Shankaracharya rambled through textbook jargon, comma, personality, form, qualities, these are all temporary features of the complete formless truth. The person is not behind, but produced of Brahman. You remember what we've been hearing with these discussions, and we're prepared, you know, at least in principle. We may not be able to quote Jiva Goswami and the verses that Jiva Goswami quotes, but at least in principle, that's the nishtha stage, as we should, our faith should be firm. I continued. Now this is reference number 3 from Ishopanishad, a verse that we know. No! The person is the basis of Brahman. Hiranmayena patrenya satyasyapi tammukam tatvam pushana parvanu satyadharmaya drishtaye. Ishopanishad, which you quoted, says that Brahman should be removed to see the face, mukham, of the ultimate. The face is the face of a person, Krishna. One removes something inferior to reveal something superior. Thus, because Krishna is the essence, Brahman is disposable. Ooh. Even in this age, everything is disposable, everything. The Shankaracharya was clearly disturbed to hear about the disposable Brahman. Showing clear discomfort at my argument, he sidestepped it to quote, of all Shastra, the Bhagavatam, and of all verses, Satyam Param Dhimahi. He said, Swamiji, Brahman is knowledge, truth, satyam. Brahman is knowledge, truth, satyam, and it is supreme, param. I was really disappointed at Shankaracharya's repertoire of half-done slokas. I fumed. But who is Param Satyam? So now it's another scriptural reference. Who is Param Satyam? Vyasadeva prays, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. It is Vasudeva, Krishna. So meditate on him. Satyam Param Dhimahi. For he is the supreme truth. That is what Param Satyam means. Param Satyam, the object of meditation, Dhimahi, at the end of the sloka, is the same Bhagavate Vasudevaya offered respects, Namaha, at the beginning. That is Jaimini's law. Now, I don't know what Jaimini's law is. Jaimini is a Karmakanda proponent. There must be some law that says what comes at the beginning. If there's a meditation upon that something, you refer back to the initial text. Meditate on what's Param Satyam. It's not specified. It's specified at the beginning. Some must be some law that Jaimini has given. I don't know what it is. A round of applause for Yogiji's completed bhajan filled the air as my opponent abandoned Shastra for incongruous logic, shaking with anger. His eyebrows furrowed. The Shankaracharya said, it is unnecessary to argue over apparent differences. Saying this, he raised his arm and pointed to one of the overhead lights at the stage right. As he did, the entire audience followed his gesture. Even Yogiji looked distracted as he continued to propound the glories of motherland, the mother tongue, and one's own mother. The Shankaracharya said, that light is energy, but it is the energy of a flowing river, now transformed into electricity. In the ultimate issue, they are one. Everywhere, there is one energy which appears in different forms, similarly Krishna. So now it's not a scriptural quote, but it's logic. Having no taste for what was coming next, I cut in. But who designed the machinery which transforms the energy of a river into the energy of light? I slapped my armdress to the surprise of some dignitaries in the first row. They were engineers, people. People manipulate energy, not vice versa. Thus, in your example, Krishna, the Supreme Person, manipulates Brahman to be the substratum energy by which he creates and pervades the world Jagat. Much to the Shankaracharya's dismay, I continued to argue his example of the stage light. When I pointed to a spotlight at stage left, the audience turned left. In his retort, the Shankaracharya pointed to a spotlight at the stage right, and the audience looked that direction, and so it went. Finally, Yogiji finished his talk, and both I and the Shankaracharya settled back in our seats. There was one thing remaining I wanted to say. I smiled at him, but Swamiji, you know what Adi Shankara said. While the MC was extolling the glories of the next speaker, the Shankaracharya replied gruffly, what is that? I said, Bhaja Govinda, Bhaja Govinda, Bhaja Govinda, and stopped. He looked at me. And for a moment, our eyes locked. It was more than a conflict of two men, more than a conflict of different schools of philosophy. It was the age-old clash of two classes of souls, those who try to justify the rebellion against Krishna and those who desire to rectify it. Gazing into his eyes, speaking very audibly, I continued, Mudhamate. The Shankaracharya jerked, shocked. In a public assembly, I had implied that he was a mudha. You know the meaning? Mudha. Fool. Mudha. Even more like a donkey. To soften the blow, I continued. So that phrase, Bhajagovinda, 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 Mudha Mate, has the second line. So he quoted the second line. Prapte sanihite kala marane. Marane has to do with death. Prapte sanihite kala marane, at the time of death, when that is approaching or that comes, twice. Nahi rakshati duskrin karane. Nahi, not at all. Rakshati, protection. You're not protected at the time of death by dukrin karane. Dukrin karane is word jugglery, grammatical interpretation. Dukrin karane. When death will be nearer, your grammatical interpretation, dukrin karane, argumentation and juggling of words will not save you. He turned away. But I said nothing. So he goes on and says, you know, anyway, perhaps I was guilty of inhospitality to a guest, an unfortunate transgression of etiquette. However, I did not want to tolerate grievous offenses to the Lord, a major spiritual transgression. Sure enough, in a moment, the Shankaracharya leaned over to me and said, "Excuse me, I must go to the toilet." He rose with his escort of followers and reassured me, "I will be back. I will be back." And he didn't come back, and you know, so it ends. I won't read the rest. I'll send this out so you can read it and go over it. There's five different points. But why are we doing this? It's not just an intellectual exercise or something like that. It's meant to protect, provide us with the means of being clear the object of our bhakti, not just a vague, notional something. Not just to protect us from Mayavad misinterpretation, that's there also, but to be very clear. So we're clear. We know what the goal is with clarity. So now we're going to continue with this section. It's Bhagavat Sandarbha, and he's going next to speak about Krishna's form that's spiritual. And then he's going to speak of the spiritual nature of Krishna's name. So reference the same form, tad rupena, was communicated as Bhagavan. The spiritual form, the Bhagavan has spiritual form, or the spiritual form is Bhagavan. So it's one of the concluding verses of Canto 12 of the whole Bhagavatam. It's Sutta speaking about Shukadeva and Maharishi Pariksit. I meditate upon this Satyam Param Dhimahi, right? I meditate upon that pure, spotless Narayana who is free from suffering and death and who previously revealed this incomparable lamp of knowledge to Brahma. Brahma then spoke it to the sage Narada, who narrated it to Krishna Dvaipayana Vyas. Srila Vyasadeva revealed this Bhagavatam to the greatest of sages, Shukadeva Goswami, and Shukadeva mercifully spoke it to Maharaj Pariksit. So it's glorification of the text that's just been narrated. Sutta has been the narrator and is glorifying the text, which is the Bhagavatam. So the Bhagavatam narrates about the spiritual form of Krishna. The spiritual nature of the name is indicated in the prayers to Krishna in Devaki's womb. And here's how it begins. This is, you know, Canto 10, Chapter 2. Prayers by the demigods to Krishna in the womb of Devaki. Canto 10, Chapter 2. Na, namarupe, guna janma, karmabhi, nirupi, tavye, tavatasya, sakshinaha, etc. O Lord, the demigods and sages pray, your name and form, representing your qualities, birth and activities, cannot be realized since you are the witness of all things and can only be inferred by logic and scripture. The devotees realize you through devotional actions. So cannot be and can be. Cannot be other than through bhakti. Through bhakti, the transcendental nature can be realized and otherwise cannot be realized by logic and reference to scripture. Cannot be understood, cannot be realized. The form of the Lord is non-material. It appears by the sort of shakti, which is self-manifesting, that was shown previously. It makes a reference to Canto 2, Chapter 9. This is Vishnu speaking to Brahma. Worshipped, or about that section, worshipped by sincere devotion, worshipped by sincere devotion, revealing his true spiritual form, the Lord spoke to Brahma the four essential verses of Bhagavatam in order to give knowledge about himself. So in chapter 9, that's the Chaturshloki verses of the Bhagavatam. It comes later, starting with text 33. This is in the early part, text 4 of Canto 2, Chapter 9. But it's indicating specifically that the form of the Lord is spiritual, and in that spiritual form he spoke the Chaturshloki verses to Brahma to reveal knowledge about himself. The commentary says, Jiva Goswami quotes, he doesn't say which commentator, since it was described in the previous chapter, and he cites 2.8.8, so chapter 8 comes before chapter 9, and in chapter 8, the beginning section is Maharaj Pariksit asking about the living entity. Living entity is transcendental. How the living entity becomes covered if he's transcendental? That's the question. So it goes to, you know, Garbhadakshay Vishnu and Brahma and that whole thing. The creation. The secondary, the primary creation. Garbhadakshay Vishnu reclining, etc. So the transcendental form of Garbhadakshay Vishnu. That's the topic. If the Supreme Personality of Godhead, from whose abdomen the lotus stem sprouted, is possessed of a gigantic body according to his own caliber and measurement, then what is the specific difference between the body of the Lord and those of common living entities? This is part of the Maharaj Pariksit's question. But he's specifying the body of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is all spiritual. The body of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is all spiritual. And from the all spiritual body of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu comes this lotus stem. So how is the body of Brahma and other living entities different than the spiritual body of Vishnu? That's the question. So, since it was described in the previous chapter that the Lord also has a form, how can bhakti to that form produce liberation? It's a bhakti question. But the principle is the form of the Lord is spiritual. So how does bhakti produce realization of that which is spiritual if by the other methods you can't understand that which is spiritual? You can't. At best, you reach something impersonal at best. Otherwise, something gobbledygook. This verse answers. For the purpose of giving knowledge of the tattva about the jiva, atmanaha, the Lord spoke to Brahma about worship through meditation. So if to understand who you are, it's necessary to approach the personality of God. Self-realization apart from realization of God is not self-realization. To get real knowledge of the self, it requires bringing the mind to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and its all spiritual identity. Then you can understand your spiritual identity. Krishna shows his eternal form filled with knowledge. Ritam, because he has been served by austerity of Yalika, Vrata, Dritaha. Avyalika is a nice word. Undivided, kind of non-pretentious Avyalika. Genuine, the real thing from the heart of Yalika. The meaning is this. By ignorance, the jiva produces a false relationship with the body. The Lord simply manifests his body of knowledge by yogamaya. That's the big difference. He has a spiritual form which he manifests by his own potency. We get a material body manifested by prakriti and identify with it and think that's us. It's very, very different. The transcendental form of the Lord and the conditioning features of the form of the living entity. Thus, by worshipping the Lord, one can attain liberation. And this is Bhagavat Sandarbha. It's not even Bhakti Sandarbha yet. So, the form, that's like such as the form shown to Brahma, expressed 294. That form was established as spiritual by Vasudeva in Srimad Bhagavatam 10.3.21. So we heard a reference from chapter 2, the demigod's prayers. Now it's Vasudeva speaking directly to Krishna. The translation, my Lord, your form is transcendental to the three material modes. Yet, for the maintenance of the three worlds, you assume the white color of Vishnu in goodness. For creation, which is surrounded by the quality of passion, you appear reddish. And at the end, when there is need for annihilation, which is surrounded by ignorance, you appear blackish. That's Vasudev. And then he's going to go through a little section. I'll just give you the preview, and then we'll read it. These features don't mean that the Lord accommodates color according to the modes of nature. Whitish over here, reddish over there, blackish over there, depending upon the modes of nature. Maintenance, creation, annihilation. That's the modes, but that's not Krishna. The meaning is this. When you, Tvam, the agent of creation, maintenance, and destruction of the material world, Saha, desire to dwell in the world, Tri Loka Stittaye, using Maya Shakti, which takes shelter of you, you protect the Brahmanas. Shukla Varnam. Shukla Varnam. The Brahmanas are dedicated to Dharma, created by you. Dharma is created by the Supreme Lord. This Maya, the Brahmanas are also a manifestation of the modes of nature. This Maya is in material sattva, since it is inferior to the Lord and suitable to Brahmanas. Brahmanas are in the mode of goodness, but not Shuddha sattva. So that's part of creation. Chaturvarna Maya Shrishtam, right? Bhagavad Gita. Guna Karma Vibhagasha. A little technical, but you'll see where it's going. When you desire to create using your Maya in Rajas, you protect the various Varnas, including Brahmanas, who have material desires. Raktam Varnam, red. Care quality. When you desire to destroy the population using Maya and Tamas, you protect those engaged in sin. Krishnam Varnam. When you desire to maintain the world, you maintain the pure form of Vishnu without mixture of the gunas. You ever had that question? Wait a minute. Vishnu's in charge of the mode of goodness. So is he like, is he tainted? Or is he untainted? How do we understand Vishnu's position? This is explaining it. Vishnu is not associated with gunas like Shiva and Brahma. Shukadeva states this. Two references, maybe want to take note of it. 1088, 5, and 3. So the first three. Shiva is always united with his personal energy, the material nature, manifesting himself in three features in response to the entreaties of nature's three modes. He thus embodies the threefold principle of material ego in goodness, passion, and ignorance. That's Lord Shiva. 1088.3. And then 1088.5. The Lord, however, has no connection with the material modes. He is the Supreme Lord, the all-seeing eternal witness, that's Vishnu, who is transcendental to material nature. One who worships him becomes similarly free from the material modes. Then he makes another reference that's not 10th canto 88, it's 10th canto chapter 13, which is chapter 13. That's the section, the Brahma-Vimohan, Leela section. So Brahma seeing what he's seeing. Those Vishnu forms by their smiling glances, which resembled the pure light of the moon, which were always tinged with red, oh, there's the color, created and protected the desires of their own devotees as if by the modes of passion and goodness. What's he doing here? The topic is this reference to colors, which comes in different places, is not to say the Lord is influenced by the modes, nor even the color that he presents has anything to do with the modes. It has to do with his internal potency. Commentary continues. The expressions concerning sattva and rajas are figurative, not real. Varnam, chatur varnam, that means the category, but it could also mean, varnam means form, not just color, such as white color. Shukla varna, white color. It's form. Since the subject concerns the gunas and indicates the forms manifested by the gunas. So, it's a category. It's not color. Although, anyway, that he's giving the reason why it should be this understanding, not that understanding. The form of Vishnu for protection, a guna avatar, is well known to be Shama, in complexion, and lives in the milk ocean. This has been shown in Paramatma Sundarbha, and the destroyer, Shiva, is known to be white in color, not black. These forms are described in the Sandhyopasana by Gobila. I don't know anything about Gobila. Brahma, is golden in complexion. Thus, there is no rule for relating to the complexions of the personalities of the gunas, baka, and other entities. At the lowest, tamas, were also blackish. We're getting close to finishing. You manifest, Vibharshi, your form to the devotees by mercy. Swamayaya. So remember circling way back this verse about the cowherd boys and those that, how fortunate are the cowherd boys. And Narada is appreciating you, the personality of Godhead, because this is chapter 37. He's been appealing to Krishna to go to Mathura and continue his pastimes, glorifying him. And he does what he does by his spiritual potency. And by his spiritual potency, he is separated from illusion. Illusion is far away from him. And those who he associates with, illusion become far away from them. And that's this swamayaya. It's his spiritual potency. So again, he manifests himself by his spiritual potency. Red represents the intense passion of creation in Rajas. Black represents the complete absence of the Sarup of the Lord in Tamas. And he quotes Canto 1, Chapter 2, a verse you're familiar with, I'm sure. Smoke is superior to dull wood. Fire, sacred to the Vedas, is superior to smoke. And similarly, Rajas is superior to Tamas. Sattva is superior to Rajas, since it is favorable for realizing the Lord. Question. The technical term is purvapaksha. Somebody that's hearing all this can say, well, wait a minute. Why do you describe through words with another meaning something which misleads people? For destroying the population, the color black is accepted by Thomas. That is the meaning. The next verse answers. This is now, again, Vasudeva speaking about Krishna in the prison. Oh, my Lord, proprietor of all creation, you have now appeared in my house, desiring to protect the world. You will kill all the armies that are moving all over the world, along with the host of demons, dressed as Kshatriya kings. It's already 8:30. I got really into that reading Shivaramarsha's offering. Maybe I should call it a halt and see if there's some discussion. There's only a little bit left. I'll just keep going. So this is his address to that doubt. This is still on the topic of colors. Nirvyuya manaha means moving about. That's in Vasudeva's words, moving about. The meaning is this. Let us forget about other proofs concerning Shuddha, Sattva, nature, Brahman. Though you appear to accept form according to the gunas, such as sleeping during pralaya, since pralaya is a matter of grief, you do not do that at this time. You should give happiness to the world by protecting it. This is Narada's appeal. Go give protection by destroying the tamasic demons. But instead, on the pretext of killing them, you mercifully give them liberation beyond the gunas. This is like, on the pretext of bringing salt, someone brings a horse. Then he explains this word saindhava can mean salt, but could also can mean horse. It is said, Canto 7, Chapter 1, Text Number 8. This is now a discussion between Narada and Yudhisthira. Quote, when sattva becomes prominent, the Lord favors the devatas and sages. When rajas becomes prominent, he favors the demons. When tamas becomes prominent, he favors the yakshas and rakshasas. The Lord acts according to the dictates of time. Commentary. Thus, black is not produced by tamas, and red and white are not produced by rajas and sattva. By the last statement, it is indicated that the Sarup Shakti is the ultimate cause. Circling back to this theme from the last several days. There's his Swarup and his Sarup Shakti, and that's what's behind everything. And people don't see the Swarup or Sarup Shakti because they're covered by illusion. But through bhakti, one can become freed from illusion and see the Lord's form and see yourself. Devaki indicates this with reverence. 10.3.24, this is the last. That form, which they say is invisible, that Shankaracharya fellow would say like that, the cause of all causes, the greatest, self-manifesting, without qualities, without change, pure existence, without variety, without action, is directly you, the Supreme Lord, who manifests our intelligence. So he gives the intelligence to the Mayavadi to see what they think is reality, and to the devotees he gives another intelligence. And it all has to do with our disposition towards him. And guided by our disciplic succession acharyas, to properly understand the message of the Bhagavatam, we can realize Krishna's form. And then we can know who we really are, simultaneously. And otherwise, it's another variety of illusion, taken to be spiritual by some people. Okay. Rigorous, huh? but practical. So let's see if there's some discussion. What do you think? A little high? You're way up there, right? But you like details. So go ahead.
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj. Some other devotees also may ask this question regarding His Holiness Shivaram Swami Maharaj offering your reading. We understand as devotees trying to practice, we have that responsibility. But at the same time, we have to see where we are. I was particularly thinking, you know, if the other person is like really high, I mean, Maharaj could take that position.
Yes.
And he did it.
Yes.
At our level, when we are not in a position to, or
you can, in your heart, you know, you have clarity. You may not articulate it because you're not in that social position, but in your heart, you should have clarity.
Yeah, this is certainly helping me to, deepen that understanding and make that firm. I'm thinking in terms of taking that responsibility, how do we, execute that responsibility in that kind of a circumstance? Do we see that?
Well, there's three options. You know from Rupa Goswami. One is take your life. The other is leave the place. And the others defeat the person in argument. You know, it's not like, so you don't have to say A to Z, but you can say something. If it's somebody that's out there. That, you know, like say there's a new person that joins your reading group or Bhakti Vriksha group or whatever, and they say, you know, blah, blah, blah. So you may choose to not get into it. You may choose to say, let's talk about that offline. You may choose, you have some choices. How are you going to address? Because that's your question. How do we execute?
The other part, Guru Maharaj, sometimes we hear, if we go that route, they may go even further away from Krishna. I mean, if they're really if they're really envious, the other person, like impersonalist or whoever, and if we go that route of trying to defeat them, or
well, you don't have to be confrontational. He was being confrontational. That's Shivaram Maharaj, his personality. But you know, he is a quality person. And that's his nature. So so somebody else may do it very differently according to their nature. But say nothing. You're at risk. They're at risk too. Cause they're not being, so yeah, you know, it takes intelligence to know your limitations and the relationship and so forth. The Western world is filled with impersonalism and voidism. So what do we do? It's very practical. The question is practical. The situation is every day. So what do we do? You know, it's some persons, a very gentle approach, some persons, very strong approach, some person somewhere in between. That takes intelligence to know which direction to move in. And we're not always intelligent. So, it makes it, trial and error. Okay. Anything else here?
Hare Krishna. My understanding is Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, and they are also not tainted by the modes, but they are under the purview of modes. They can get affected sometimes. Is that correct? Because they are also like pure devotees. They are like above the modes, the way we understand, but sometimes they can get trapped.
Well, they're pure devotees, but we just read, Lord Shiva is in direct contact. Now, to what degree is he influenced by that direct contact? To some degree. Brahma is a pure devotee. They're both heads of sampradayas. They're pure devotees. To some degree. And he becomes influenced sometimes. There's still apichet sudharaja robajate mamananyabhak sadhu rebus. So there, we regard them as sadhu, exalted souls. We don't look at the, you know, the rare special occasion kind of discrepancies, but that's there. There's sadhu. And there's some tinge. Unlike Vishnu, no tinge. Okay?
Yes, Maharaj. In the same lines, I think in the, some places Prabhupada compares Haridas Thakur and with Lord Shiva in the second chapter.
Yes.
So how do we understand that?
He's more elevated. That's how we understand it. That's why that reference is given. He's in a very special position. More elevated. One? Okay.
This question is from Daivi Shakti Mataji.
Okay.
So her question is, I'm hearing your lectures on Say Yes to Nama Prabhu through Sadhu Sangha Srimati Krishna Shakti Mataji. I'm feeling so old and want to advance quickly in my spiritual life, and I'm unable to have full concentration while chanting. What should I do? How should I advance?
Pray a lot. I mean, you're listening to the recordings. The explanation is there. I could repeat it, but it's there. I'll share one thing. Just adds to the message. I was hearing a class given by Srila Prabhupada in Vrindavan where he was explaining a verse. He just said it's from Rupa Goswami, so I followed. It's a verse from Padyavali. Text number 17 from Padyavali. It doesn't say who the author is. Maybe it's himself. Because Padyavali is just a collection of his favorite verses. And sometimes it says author unknown. Sometimes it gives the name of the author. In this case, it doesn't give either. But Prabhupada said, this lecture I heard, Canto 1, Chapter 2 lecture, is this is the verse from which, based upon this verse, he named Krishna consciousness. So she can look it up, or you can send it to her, Padyavali 17. And Bhakti Rasa is how it starts. And Matihi. So the verse that's speaking, it's Lalyam is there, but Prabhupada, rather than saying greed, he speaks about eagerness. So that's, there has to be an eagerness. You're feeling some eagerness, your age, concentration isn't what it could be, should be, would be. Eagerness. And that's the price. That's the price. You have to pay the price for something that's valuable. And the price is eagerness. And bhakti rasa is, so it's not, you know, so it's what you want it to be. There's an actual, Krishna reveals himself through his name to such a person who has eagerness. It's not like tomorrow morning it's going to happen, but it's a cultivation through the medium of eagerness. You just keep paying the price, however many times, as much as you can, eagerness. And that's, thereby one can progress through the stages of bhakti to the higher stages of bhakti. Our eagerness is towards the temporary. And, you know, in her age, it's a lifetime of distraction. And it's not easy to overcome distraction. That it's not easy for a young person either to overcome distraction. And it's somewhere in between and the old person. It's not easy. How are we going to get a taste instead of, like your question of, you know, doing some, making an offering or performing an arti and it's mechanical. How do we get beyond mechanical? Same question. There's a process and bhakti can carry us beyond the mechanical, but so there has to be an eagerness. An eagerness for what? You know, it's not just salvation. Let me out of this crazy place. It's getting crazier all the time. Let me out of here. It's not salvationism. That's not eagerness. That's negation. That's not eagerness. Eagerness is to be in our relationship with Krishna again. And, you know, we have other things that are important to us. A lifelong, many lifetimes of other things that are important to us. And that's where we're paying the dues. We're accountable for our many lifetimes of mistaken use of free will. But Krishna will see the eagerness that you have to connect with him. And he will reciprocate with that. That's our hope. That's what to do.
So this question is from Amara Mataji. There was a line in the ending narration that he or Krishna works according to dictates of time. Can you kindly help me understand? Perhaps I have missed the context.
You know, time is his energy. So time doesn't dictate to him. He dictates to time. He isn't controlled by his energy. So the meaning is not he's controlled by his energy. But when it's time to move on to another pastime, he moves on to another pastime, another exchange, another mood. You know, it's a question that was asked yesterday about the transcendental nature of Krishna's activities in the world where there's time as we know it, past, present, future time. So how do the two interplay together? He's moving from one pastime to another. It's by his will that time moves and time moves things along. In the external world and in his internal world, it's all according to his icha, his independent free will. So it's a conventional kind of expression, not he's controlled by time.
And this is from Urja Mataji. What internal mood should be kept in me while clearing the misconceptions like Mayavad thinks with others?
It's similar to your question. I mean, we want to be in service to Krishna. We don't want to push people away from Krishna. At the same time, they need to be protected and we need to be protected. So you have to, your mood should be pleasing Krishna and helping this person come closer to Krishna. However you do that depends upon you and the circumstance and intelligence and things. But the mood is to help them come closer to Krishna.
This question is from Sandhya Mataji. Isn't Brahma Samhita a direct attack on Mayavad philosophy?
Sure. Revealing Krishna is a direct attack on Mayavad philosophy. Prabhupada ki jai.